We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I have my maple coffee and it is quite amazing. I hope that you have your beverage of preference. If you're not a coffee person, I just question how you can be up in the morning. Or maybe you'll be a person who listens to this episode later on in the afternoon if you're not a coffee drinker. But coffee is just one of the greatest things in life. I love it every morning. But let's talk about the headlines. So police have made no arrest in the anti-Israel protests outside the White House. So last weekend, of course, we saw the videos that came out of that, and there was a lot of just extreme vulgarity and extreme disgusting behavior. I mean, there was certainly violence. There was, you know, the raising of that bloody mask that was an effigy of Joe Biden. And so according to Daily Wire, various law enforcement agencies said they did not make any arrests related to the anti-Israel protest on Saturday, in which people trashed a park next to the White House. The Secret Service, D.C. police, and U.S. Park Police said they did not even detain anyone in connection to the demonstration, if you want to call it a demonstration, at Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C., that left a number of statues vandalized. So what does this sound like? Well, it sounds exactly like 4 years ago and the summer of mostly peaceful protests and the summer of violence when we saw all of the preferences from various law enforcement agencies and especially elected officials and also all of these health officials that said it's totally fine if you want to go out and riot and be part of BLM and do all of those kinds of things. But if you want to just put your child in school, for example, well, no, then, you know, then you are a danger to society and you have to wear your masks, including kids under, you know, under 2 years old even, and do all this social distancing nonsense and everything, which now Anthony Fauci has just recently testified that he just made all of that up. But we knew that anyway. We knew that in the summer of 2020 because it was absolutely logically impossible. It was a logical absurdity to suggest that a virus is political, right? That it knows, okay, this viewpoint is preferred by the regime, so it's totally fine, and the virus isn't gonna attack people at a BLM rally, and they're outside and in close quarters and just, you know, throngs of people, and when they're protesting, but when it's a Christian gathering in church, for example, well, that's when we're really gonna attack. I mean, it was beyond comprehension. Everybody knew it, and yet the left always puts this forward with a totally straight face. Because they actually genuinely believe in social justice instead of true justice. And this is what we're seeing again this summer, is that very same concept of social justice over actual justice. And let's contrast that now, and police not making any arrests in the anti-Israel protests outside the White House. I mean, remember, there's vandalism, there's violence, and yet teenagers are being put in jail and charged with felonies, first-degree malicious mischief, for leaving skid marks on a street mural of a pride flag. So this coming from hot air, in case anyone had questions of selective justice. We live in the weirdest times. Times when you can get arrested for driving in the street, but not for trashing schools, libraries, national monuments, or even attacking the police. And Andy Ngo, who has been a guest on this program, said that three teens are each charged with a felony, first-degree malicious mischief, for leaving scooter skid marks on the Pride Trans BLM flag on the street, and prosecutors are asking for a $15,000 bond. And Lime Bike, which is, you know, one of those, like, share, you can go and rent it and then do your scooter and, you know, drop it off. So Lime Bike says it's taking action against the youths for using their rental to go and put skid marks. But why are we even painting pride flags on the street and then we're shocked when people drive over them? I mean, it's again, it is a logical absurdity, but I love the headline from Hot Air. It says, don't paint your religious symbols on the street. If you don't want anybody to drive over them, then maybe don't put them on the street. But even then, there was a whole thread from a couple of social media influencers. And one of the main problems that I have with X, and this is a kind of sidetrack of the conversation, but one of the main problems that I have with X, and I'm grateful to Elon Musk for buying the platform. It's great that conservatives by and large are not censored the way that they were under Jack Dorsey. But the way that he has used the platform to encourage monetizing, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with monetizing your account, but the way that that encourages just sheer engagement over actual conversation, I think is a detriment to the overall public forum that is X. And political Twitter or political X is the main conversation that a lot of people have on from elected officials and all the way down. And Devin Nunes, of course, who's the CEO of Truth Social, I think rightly says that X is mainly just a press release kind of forum. You send it out almost like a wire or different comments and things like that. But so it's become this almost a manipulation of itself that a lot of these social media influencers now, just because they want to monetize their accounts more heavily, they will just post things that are intended in some cases to be rather stupid just to get engagement. But one of them was this conservative, more MAGA account posted a picture of a pride flag that showed it on fire and said, you know, something to the effect of we should burn all of the pride flags. Fine, that's protected speech. And this kind of center leftist influencer, of course, wants engagement, and so is like, well, this is hate speech, and goes on this whole thing, and is like, why isn't X condemning this and taking stuff like this off the platform? And, you know, and I reminded this guy, because he follows me on social media, and I reminded him, well, the U.S. American flag, the Supreme Court has held in a case, Texas versus Johnson, to say that symbolic speech, like burning a flag, is protected. But of course, that becomes totally different when it's the pride flag. And the pride flag isn't even the flag of a country. It's the flag of an ideology. It is basically a religious flag. I would actually compare it, rather than a flag of a nation like the United States, I would say that the pride flag is more akin to the Christian flag in terms of the category in which it belongs. Because it is an ideology, it's a religion, and it is a worldview. And that's more why these leftists have such a problem with burning the pride flag and leaving skid marks on these leftist, Marxist religious symbols on the street than they do even with burning a flag of a great country, even by its own citizens, which we all understand, as much as, you know, I am fully against the notion of burning the U.S. flag. I think there are a lot of better ways you can voice your opposition to some of the politics in the United States. But I'm not going to say that that's hate speech or that it should be punished criminally under a criminal code. And yet, the left is now suggesting that if you want to burn a pride flag, or if you want to, like these kids, just, you know, go and create skid marks and do donuts on the street, and it happens to be over a pride symbol, that is somehow hate speech, that is now malicious criminal mischief. I mean, it's beyond absurd what they're actually doing, because it's not about leaving a skid mark in a street. It's not about doing, you know, donuts in a street. It's not about not respecting the stop signs or, you know, any of the traffic signals or anything like that. It is all about, you will not disrespect our new religion. And this is all a matter of social justice. And Hot Air is right to say that this is selective justice. And the thing that bothers Christians and conservatives about this is not just the fact that we obviously disagree with the entire Pride, LGBTQ, Rainbow Mafia agenda, and we would say that is a false religion, but the fact that our society, that is required and actually commanded by God in the institution of government to enact true, real, meaningful justice, when there is selective justice or there is social justice, that offends our very being and understanding of God's nature and his character. Because defining justice is not a matter of politics, it's not a matter of preferences, it's not a matter of government viewpoint compulsory action. It's not to say we prefer BLM and pride and leftist rhetoric and whatever any leftists want to post on a public forum like X, and that's fine. And then anything we disagree with, like declining to bake a cake, declining a website, or posting Christian messages or Christian content, or, you know, burning a pride flag, all of that we're going to say is impermissible. That is selective justice. And the Bible references true justice and the word justice to mean to make right. Making right, enacting meaningful justice, is part of the nature and character of God. And it has to flow from objective moral truth and objective measurable standards of the difference between right and wrong that is not politically based or based in just someone's ideology. And this is where we as Christians have to be better at our argument to say that objective truth is not just a matter of my faith and my religion over your faith and your religion. It is not a clash of I want a Christian society versus you want a Marxist, liberal, leftist society. And then we have basically an equal playing ground of a clash of ideology that I'm imposing my worldview versus your worldview. It has to come from an objective, truthful source. And if we just have man's collective judgment and we say that this is all a social contract and we get to determine what type of justice we prefer, then we get into a clash of, well, don't impose your faith on me. And Christians have been set back on their heels by that whole nonsense for a really long time. We have to say it is not me imposing my truth and my perspective and my faith on you. It is a matter of what is right. That's not a matter of opinion. Justice is objective. Truth is objective. And if we are following the truth of the reality to which we are presented, we will have measurable, meaningful justice as a rational term, living in a right relationship with each other in our community and in society. We can't have selective social justice Otherwise, it will all depend on those who are in power. And this is why I reject, but for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons that I reject this notion of so-called Christian nationalism as a term, because it implies specifically that we are simply, as Christians, wanting to impose our worldview and our selective justice instead of looking to God as the author of all things and an objective source outside of man that defines truth, and from truth outflows things like meaningful justice. So we have to reject the world's definition, and we have to continue to enact meaningful justice in society. We'll be right back with more.
The Word of God tells us many times in one form or another, fear not. Many people are very fearful about some of the many perils and dangerous happenings that are going on in the world. Psalm 91 verses 1 and 2 tell us, "He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him I will trust." I'm Joseph Parker, and we here at the American Family Association would like to remind you, fear not. Put your trust in the Lord. We'd like to both encourage and challenge you to aggressively put your faith to work. And one way to do that is to pray Psalm 91 daily for yourself and your family, and keep your trust in Him. If you'd like to get a copy of the Psalm 91 prayer for yourself, email us here at psalm91@afa.net. Again, that's psalm91@afa.net.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And Adam, my excellent producer, just told me in the break that he is not a coffee drinker. And I said, well, this explains everything then of like, this explains his entire personality. And he is rejecting my truth that coffee is amazing. And that is okay, because it should be an objective truth that coffee is fantastic and everyone should have that in the morning. But I guess he rejects that. That's okay. We'll have to work on him. Feel free to send all of your comments on why Adam should drink coffee. but we'll continue. And speaking of justice and meaningful justice and law that is predicated on objective truth, this headline was just so sad. This coming from the Telegraph in the United Kingdom. Why the Dutch are euthanizing physically healthy young adults, could the UK be next? And joining me now to discuss this very heavy topic is Walker Wildman, our great vice president here at the American Family Association. And Walker, this story chronicled a young woman who is 40 and waiting to hear if she will be legally allowed to decide herself to end her life. And this is based more on what she describes it as a mental health sort of issue. But the biblical worldview response to this, of course, is that just as we are pro-life at the very beginning and the conception of life, we are pro-life all the way until natural death, because no one can or should choose when to end their life. That is up to, the Bible says that God numbers our days. And so to allow under the law people to say, you know, I'm done with life, like completed life bills, for example, that are in many of the states now in the U.S. and being contemplated, this offends the very notion of what it means to be a human being made in God's image and look to God as the author of life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is exhibit A of what happens when man thinks he's God, or man thinks she's God. So as you said, we're all created in the image of God. We're not all God's children. There's a distinct difference there. Some Christians say that we're all God's children. Well, no, we're not all God's children. If you're in the household of faith and you believe in Jesus, yes, you are a child of God. But every human, even unbelievers, are created in the image of God. They're image bearers. And it's God that numbers our days. God created us. The natural life cycle plays itself out with every human being. And that's one area, Jenna, that equality or equity definitely has its part, because we're all going to face death. No, it doesn't matter what income class you're a part of, what your skin color is, et cetera. We're all going to face eternity, whether you're a billionaire or you're living in poverty in some undeveloped nation. We're all going to see death at some point on our doorstep. So, but it isn't man's job to take the place of God and pick and choose who gets to live and who gets to die. That's what Nazi Germany did, and it's a very, very bad idea. Also, just another thing I want to point out is, and you know this well, being a lawyer and studying, you know, the Constitution, just because the government says it's okay doesn't mean it's okay. We've seen governments throughout human history that do very, very evil things. And just because the government says it's okay doesn't mean it's okay. God created government. Government's supposed to be a force for good, but from time to time, just like man, government can go to the wayside and do very, very evil things. And so I wanted to make that point as well. Just because the government, quote unquote, legalizes it doesn't mean it's moral, doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And Jenna, this is basically, if I were to help somebody kill themselves, I would be criminally investigated, and very, very, very likely I would go to jail for aiding in a suicide. And I could be charged with some type of homicide, even though it may be second or third degree. But this is the government doing it. So the government is helping people kill themselves, and they're calling it a good thing. I mean, this is so illegal. It goes against natural law, goes against the common law. Government is supposed to be a life-preserving agent. You don't go into a hospital for them to kill you. You go into the hospital to be saved. Same thing with the government. We create governments. God created government. We institute governments at the local level to preserve lives. So this goes against virtually every aspect of government's sole function, and that is to preserve life.
Yeah, so well said. And what you're describing, Walker, is the difference between legal versus lawful. So something can be legal in a society, and that doesn't necessarily make it, by definition, then lawful or comporting with a moral and upright objective standard. And so the example that you brought up with Nazi Germany, for example, there were a lot of things that were legal according to the law that the government had instituted or dictators have instituted, but that doesn't make it morally permissible. And so we as Christians have to ensure that we continually draw that distinction and encourage our civil government that any laws that they create or any actions that they either permit or prohibit in society comport with a lawful, moral, and upright standard. And so this is the topic that we're discussing this morning is a perfect example of how something can be permissible and permitted by government, but is absolutely evil and wrong and immoral. And the whole abortion debate also fits into that category, that just because the government says it's okay, or just because the majority of justices in Roe versus Wade, that thankfully now has been overturned, said that there is a so-called right to choose an abortion for any reason, that somehow becomes morally permissible. And so we have to draw that distinction, I think, moving forward as Christians, and ensure that just because our government says, well, you know, this is what we permit in society, that we don't then say, oh, well, then that must be okay, and take our moral views from a government that unfortunately is increasingly not just secular, but intentionally evil.
Yeah, and there's been a saying that's gone around. I think Thomas Sowell might have coined it, but nonetheless, it talks about how government is downstream from culture. And a lot of Christians talk about that. I've even probably parroted the phrase a couple times. And what they're talking about is that culture basically creates government. So the type of culture that you have will then determine who your leaders are and the direction they go. And that's true in a sense. It's not wholly untrue, but there is some caveats to this, because there are cases where government then influences the culture. Government influences the public. So it's not just a one-way street. This is more like a circular matrix, if you will, where every part of society and culture and government, they all start affecting one another. And this is the case here. If government says something is legal, even though it's 100% immoral and unbiblical, that begins to wear off on the culture, on the people of a society, and people start looking at the government saying, well, the government said it was good, it was right, it was true, so it must be. That's what's happening with marriage. That's what happened with abortion. And unfortunately, that's what could happen with this type of assisted suicide standards, is people could start looking at this saying, well, if the government says I can do it, then it must be good, it must be true. And that's a very dangerous path to go. So we must always remember that government also influences culture and society, and be on guard for that, and not just the other way around. Sometimes you can have a good culture, but then you have bad leaders, and that takes the culture down with it.
Yeah, really, really well said. I'm speaking with Walker Wildman, who's the vice president here at the American Family Association and host of At the Core, which you can listen to on AFR. And obviously, all the past episodes are at AFR.net. And it's a great admonition to recognize that even though God has given specific limited authority to the institutions that he has ordained, the civil government, the church government, the family government, those who are in power or who exercise authority in those institutions can do that in a way that is evil. And we've seen examples of that. We've seen examples of pastors who have exercised their authority in churches or elder boards or even teachers who have gone against the authority that God has given them and have used that in ways that are wrong. We've seen, of course, parents are not 100% correct all the time. I mean, they can use parental authority for evil. And the same thing with the civil government. Just because God created those institutions doesn't mean that always the fallible human beings that are exercising the authority will always be exercising legitimate authority. And that becomes the broader conversation about, for example, submission and civil disobedience in the context of civil government. When is it permitted morally to exercise civil disobedience? Well, when the government is not acting with legitimate, rightful authority. And so this is a great example of how the government, because there is this intrinsic aspect of legitimacy to the government, because we know that it's an institution God has ordained, then what the government legislates and what it sets up and what it enacts in terms of justice carries an aura of legitimacy just because of the power that it's given. And you're right to bring up the marriage topic, because this is why I think the entire leftist LGBTQ rainbow mafia went after the definition of marriage, because they were not satisfied to just get the legal protections of, for example, a civil union or right of survivorship or custody of kids or some of those legal things, tax breaks. They wanted the moral legitimacy that comes with a government saying, we recognize a homosexual union as a marriage. They wanted the moral legitimacy, which we know they can never get, because it doesn't matter if the government is exercising their authority in an illegitimate manner. But now that the government has done that, and we're now 10 years almost from, next year will be the 10-year anniversary of the Obergefell versus Hodges decision, and we are seeing that cultural impact by a society that has been persistently told for 10 plus years that marriage can be between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, or, three women and a dog now, apparently, according to the left. I mean, it's utterly absurd, but we're seeing the social ramifications of that.
Yeah, we are. We're seeing a deteriorating culture, and you see how quickly the conversation moves. I mean, we went from abortion to the sexual revolution, to two men want to say that they're married, to transgenderism, and then now we're talking about killing people. We're talking about the government authorizing the killing of people. And so that just shows how quickly things deteriorate. I mean, there's this naive mentality that, oh, no, we would never do that. I mean, how many times have we heard people that are naive, sitting on the sidelines with their hands in their pockets saying, oh, no, that'll never happen. Well, you know how many times we can quote people that said, oh, no, that'll never happen, and exactly what happened? The exact thing that we predicted. I mean, my grandfather predicted much of this back in the 70s and 80s that we've seen come to fruition. So we can't be naive to that. Also, Christians, to your point, Jenna, need to really be studied up biblically, theologically, on what civil disobedience looks like. What's the biblical framework and guidelines to civil disobedience? Because we're increasingly becoming a society of unjust, immoral, unbiblical rules and laws, and at some point that's going to come across, and the government is going to want us to sanction sin, and we just can't do it. We just can't do that as Christians. So whether we're talking about California tried to do this where they wanted to place abortion referrals in pro-life clinics. This was going to be an example of forced speech, which is completely unconstitutional. Thankfully, that was struck down. We've seen parental rights be nullified because parents don't go along with the gender dysphoria garbage. There's example after example where the government has tried to intervene and force people to do the wrong thing. So we just have to study up on this and be prepared and be really at peace with it biblically and spiritually, because the comfortable America maybe that we grew up in isn't so comfortable after all. But not all is bleak. Not all is lost. We have to fight for our culture, fight for our society, and really be on offense as much as we can so we can share the truth and the gospel of Jesus.
Yes, that is so absolutely true, and that we do need to know the measurable difference between right and wrong according to truth and the Word of God. And because we are in an increasingly immoral and evil society, we also have to understand the contours and the guardrails of civil disobedience, because one of the things that I'm seeing, Walker, in a lot of the right, as a very broad definition for purposes of this conversation, you know, that would include Christians and non-Christians, but people, you know, who are just to the right politically, because there are so many things increasingly that we disagree with, we tend to then stand up and fight for and against everything that also falls within our own personal preferences that isn't necessarily a matter of right versus wrong. So there is a difference, for example, between if the government is compelling you as a pastor to sanction a same-sex marriage, you can't go along with that. This was John MacArthur's stand, and so many Christians who said, no, when the government is telling us we can't meet as a church, we have to reject that because that is commanding us to go against what Scripture has commanded. And there are some very clear distinctions, but if it's some policy or something that we don't particularly like or we disagree with, that is not always an instance to stand up and say, well, I am going to fight tooth and nail and I'm not going to obey my government. I mean, our founding fathers would have called those light and transient causes, and they did not enact the revolution and put out the Declaration of Independence over those types of disagreements. So we need to be very biblically sound to rightly divide the topics of what falls under legitimate civil disobedience versus just maybe conservative rebellion, if we can characterize it that way.
Yeah, one last word I'll say to give an example. The Biden administration was going to force AFA, our entity, to under the OSHA agency to force all of our employees to get this COVID shot, which is not a vaccine. And we decided early on in the lawsuit, we're not doing this. It's immoral and unethical for an employer to force any type of medicine or shot upon someone's body that's not our body. It's their body created in the image of God. So we said, we're not doing that. Now, thankfully, we won at court, but we were ready to defy the government over that immoral mandate that could have done a ton of harm to our employees. So that's where we drew the line. But we do have to be very selective and very accurate and biblical on where we draw the line.
Yeah, and that's a great example of standing up against, you know, something not just that is unconstitutional, for example, but is actually immoral and wrong. I mean, and now with so many things that have come out of about the vaccines, for example, and impacts that it may have on fertility, you know, so many other things. I mean, that was why my cousin, who is a nurse in a NICU, she was at the time had just had her first son, and they were looking to have more children, and her main objection to the vaccine was because she just said, I just don't know what type of impact it may have on reproductive health, and, you know, to use a leftist term, but you know, that entire category of fertility. And so those things, to be a good steward of our bodies and understanding, this is why things like birth control are a very very important topic for Christians, regardless of what the government says is permitted or what they compel on us. We have to choose the biblically, morally correct thing and be willing to suffer the consequences if we exercise civil disobedience, but then also recognize when there are times that we just have a rebellious attitude and maybe need to say, okay, I disagree with my government in this instance. I want to drive 50 miles an hour on this road, but it only says 20, for example. That's an instance where you should obey your civil government. That's not a matter of moral right versus wrong. So that's a much heavier topic, but I'm glad that we've at least broached it in this segment. So we're already out of time, but Walker Wildman, we should discuss more on civil disobedience coming up soon. Thanks so much for your time this morning. And we do just absolutely need to study God's word so that we can apply it correctly and biblically to our everyday lives. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And speaking of being good stewards of government and ensuring that legislation is appropriate to address the issues of our day, there is a California State Senate bill. It's SB 1047 that is titled The Safe and Secure Innovation for Frontier Artificial Intelligence Models Act, which is the first major piece of legislation aiming to regulate artificial intelligence in the state that hosts much of the tech industry. So this article that is in compactmag.com is titled California's Gift to Big Tech, and it's by Jake Denton, who is a tech policy advisor for the Heritage Foundation, and he joins us now. So Jake, I always appreciate your insights on AI. I think this is a topic that, you know, continues to be at the forefront of the headlines, because this is something that we as a nation are going to have to continue to deal with. And we're seeing even more and more iterations of AI. I mean, just in the last week, I'm starting to see on different social media platforms, you can tag your posts with, you know, with AI. There was even an article that I addressed on my Salem TV show last night that was so ridiculous, that was about a beauty pageant for artificial intelligence created models and quote unquote influencers. I mean, which is so absurd. But let's talk specifically about California and what California's gift is to big tech. And good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for having me. Well, you know, you mentioned that this stuff is everywhere. We're seeing it in the news headlines. Every app is adopting it. But what we're really not getting a lot of in mainstream news is coverage on what's happening at the state level when it comes to regulating the technology. We talked last week that there's more than 400 pieces of legislation being considered at the state level for AI. And SB 1047 is one of the craziest we've probably seen thus far. And what I kind of get into in the piece is that's precisely the point. You know, they're really making a play for keeps here. They recognize in California that if they go to the craziest degree possible, that the rest of the country will have to follow them, because at the federal level, we're not going to get AI legislation. So they're really trying to take advantage of their position, you know, having Silicon Valley and having a very far left legislature to push through a very crazy bill, which would essentially allow for them to block progress. You know, they're going to essentially erect a box around some of the biggest players, essentially OpenAI, that can foot a compliance bill to the degree that SB 1047 will require. And just about everyone else will be boxed out of the market. So it's a very significant bill for not just Silicon Valley, but the entire country, where, you know, AI is rapidly evolving and we might just have one or two companies that we deal with.
This is really fascinating how, you know, the state of California can regulate this, because that so much of the tech industry is located in California and have such an impact on the nation. Is this in conflict in any way with what Congress is potentially looking to do in terms of AI and their legislation?
Yeah, so recently Senator Schumer put out a roadmap that was essentially supposed to be a loose framework for how the Congress at a federal level should proceed with AI regulation. And what was unique about the roadmap is that it identified essentially a use case-based regulatory pathway. So instead of focusing on a model of a particular size or power, you're going to say, you know, we're just really concerned about AI and maybe healthcare, and in particular, how that could implicate privacy. And that is really the direction, you know, give Schumer his credit, that we should be taking. We shouldn't say, you know, if a model is this powerful, it just can't be on the market. It's more, you know, if this model is being used in healthcare, regardless of power, needs to kind of follow a more stringent set of rules. This is very common sense. In many ways, it resembles the arguments over gun rights. You know, a lot of people try and push for restrictions on guns of a certain caliber. Essentially, it's the same thing here. We're trying to restrict your ability to have high-powered systems that could make you a great deal of money and make your life a lot easier. So it's a total power grab.
That's really fascinating. And there's always something more to legislation like this than just meets the eye. And that's why I'm grateful that people like you in a specific industry and, you know, policy area will research exactly what the implications are of legislation like this. And so when we talk about, you know, things like a digital bill of rights, and President Trump and his campaign have certainly put that out, I think this has been over a year ago now, at least. When we talk about AI and some of the ways that this impacts individual users, does that fall under, or should it fall under, a digital bill of rights type of framework?
Yeah, I think it's actually a bit more niche than, you know, AI itself. What I think really is going to be at play for a digital bill of rights is a right to compute, you know, the right to actually have access to computer chips of a certain power that are required for such a model, you know, like whether it be OpenAI's model or, you know, you're running something locally out of your garage, you need computer chips that are very powerful. And what you're seeing across the country are state legislatures and even at the federal level want to restrict your ability to purchase certain calibers of computer chips. And that is a really crazy power grab. Not a lot of people talk about this. But it could completely devastate your ability to cash in on the AI revolution and really just allow the spoils to go directly to big tech. And so that is really something that in the AI context with the digital bill of rights that we have to push for. And then broadly, I think, you know, privacy and these types of things that apply across the entire digital space will have increased value. You know, we need those protections in an AI world in particular.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense. And so, you know, we've talked a lot, and I'm speaking with Jake Denton, who is a research associate in the Tech Policy Center at the Heritage Foundation. You can follow him on X, on social media, at Real J Denton. And I would encourage you to, because then you will be able to see, you know, all of his articles and other things and commentary on this. I love following, you know, a lot of different people in various topics and policy and all of that, who are, you know, much more up on these things than I am, and then get their expertise. So always appreciate your time here. And so, you know, as we move forward, as a entire world, I think, with AI, and we've talked about this a lot, Jake, with Washington not really, I think, being able to handle a lot of this, at least, or at least it doesn't seem like they particularly want to. What do you think are the main areas of concern that that either Congress or even the executive branch needs to address more immediately, while still allowing for, you know, some opportunities for the entrepreneurs to not have all of these barriers to access?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing where we're at right now is they need clear, innovators, entrepreneurs need clear signs of where they can't go. There's a lot of ambiguity over the regulatory environment, how, you know, old laws might apply to new innovation. They need to know exactly for certain that they can't build in a certain direction, so that there isn't a huge opportunity cost of, you know, devoting resources to them being told you're not allowed to do something. So we need regulation and law to essentially build those guardrails, so that we can march in a straight line and really, you know, push this thing into the future, so that we can beat China at this race and actually have a better country that is, you know, optimized and built on top of AI, rather than, you know, a chaos free-for-all where, you know, people are building where they shouldn't, and you know, we're losing out on some great opportunity, great innovation. So we need clarity, I think, is the biggest thing. And we also need to move, you know, a little bit quicker than we are, simply because at the state level, one or two of these crazy proposals are going to make it through, and it's going to have a ripple effect over how we govern AI for everybody. And so, you know, if you're in Washington, D.C., you shouldn't be governed by California state legislature. Same thing with, you know, middle Americans just kind of looking around like, why am I living under a different state's authority? That's something we need to, like, be really cognizant of and, you know, move quickly so that we can, you know, live in an America rather than, you know, under California's rule.
Yeah, and that's a great point as well. And so, you know, this SB 1047 that is, as you write in here, the bill is now barreling toward a vote in the state assembly, which is expected to take place sometime this summer. How would you encourage those who are listening in California, maybe a call to action there, and then for people who are not in California, to let their state legislatures know that this is potentially a threat to their rights in other states?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news is there's a ton of content on SB 1047. You can read my piece, or you can go on X and see all of these different people pushing back against it. And the state assembly members absolutely know that this is coming. And so you should capitalize on this moment. It's an issue they've all read up on, and really make your voice heard. Let them know that, you know, you're concerned about the way this is headed. And at the, you know, individual state level, maybe you're outside of California, I think it's important to, you know, call your state and local representatives, make sure that they're aware that, you know, these lavishly funded nonprofits, which I touch on, are not, you know, altruistic, great organizations pushing for safety. They're funded by big tech and pushing for regulatory capture. And so it's really about, you know, being engaged in this conversation, not just letting the, you know, PhD lab coats and the big tech funded groups come in and take your country from you. So be active. It's kind of a dorky issue, but it's an important one to engage on for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's one that I think for most people who are just, you know, average Americans, you know, maybe they're not super into the tech space and all of these, it can seem overwhelming to say, okay, well, you know, we just want to focus on one or two issues that are the priority to us. And it's almost like, you know, people can get so overwhelmed. But this is where a lot of these groups, like the Heritage Foundation, like AFA Action, for example, you know, will have a lot of resources that can help you not only prioritize, but also just get sort of the key points so that you can be conversant and at least aware of what is going on, and then take action if you prefer. And you can, but we should be engaged citizens, and we should know what is coming up in our legislature. So this is California. In just the last 2 minutes I have with you, Jake, is there anything coming up in terms of Congress and legislation on this issue that people should be aware of that they may want to engage in as well?
Yeah, there's a data privacy bill that is moving through the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the American Data Privacy Rights Act, APRA is the acronym, and it has a ripple effect across all of the tech space, including AI, and it would really change the way that you control your data. It would really make for certain that, you know, these companies can't abuse your, you know, personal information to profit on, you know, maybe an AI tool. So I think at the federal level, what is happening is we're starting to kind of backfill old issues we kind of have neglected, and that'll have a downstream effect on new technologies like AI as well. So even on these data privacy issues, it's important to engage if you're interested in AI, because it'll certainly implicate AI.
Yeah, well, really well said. Jake Denton, always appreciate it. Again, you can follow him at RealJDenton on X. And his article, California's Gift to Big Tech, is at compactmag.com. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Make it a great day, and I will see you tomorrow. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.